content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Jen Rogers for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I shall be reading to you from Smithsonian, the magazine of the Smithsonian Institute. Today's program is underwritten with the generous support of the Kevin family. We wish to thank them for their support. On today's program, we'll begin with an article titled Hot Days, Cool Heads by Julie Winoker. In Miami, the nation's first chief heat officer charts a course for surviving on a warming planet. Jane Gilbert has one foot submerged in mud as she lowers a small cypress tree into the ground. Sweat seeps through her shirt, even though it's barely hot by Miami-Dade standards. A mere 86 degrees with cloying humidity. Gilbert and a group of Girl Scouts are planting 500 native trees in the Miami area city of Coral Gables to help mitigate climate change. Sometimes you feel like a tadpole in front of a tsunami, says Gilbert, but there's a sense of urgency because there's so much opportunity right now. In 2021, Gilbert became the world's first chief heat officer, and the opportunity she's referring to is a constellation of federal and local support for confronting one of the biggest challenges of the 21st century. She is aware that the national political winds could shift, so she's working in overdrive to make change happen at the county level. You might call Gilbert a heat evangelist, as she preaches the hazards of rising temperatures and offers the people of Miami-Dade County a path toward salvation. Since her appointment, she has helped transform one of the country's hottest places into a beacon for resilient urban planning. According to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, there were a record 120,000 heat-related emergency room visits nationwide last year. In South Florida, it is no longer a question of if, but when the heat will become intolerable. Miami-Dade just doesn't have summer anymore. It can have 6 months of temperatures above 90 degrees with 70% humidity. Last year, Miami had an unprecedented 42 days with a heat index at or above 105 degrees. Although the thermometer might read 95 degrees, the heat index takes humidity into account and reflects how hot it actually feels. By comparison, over the previous 14 years, the heat index only hit the level for an average of 6 days per year. When the city's public buses flash signs that read, "Go Miami Heat," the irony is hard to miss. Gilbert formerly served as Miami's chief resilience officer, helping develop and implement the city's response to climate-related pressures such as rising sea levels. Gilbert explains that historically the risk from heat has been underreported. Emergency room doctors and nurses often don't think to identify dizziness, seizures, and high body temperature as heat-related symptoms. It's now clear, though, that heat exposure is the leading cause of weather-related deaths in the country. In the past, heat was addressed through different sectors of the county's Department of Emergency Management and by urban planners. There was no one looking at how to address the issue more holistically, Gilbert explains. And so the idea was to have a position that would break down the silos and look at what are the big health risks and economic burdens associated with extreme heat. The position was created by the Adrian Arsht Rockefeller Foundation Resilience Center, which works with community partners to address the looming crisis of rising temperatures. In Miami-Dade, where the philanthropist Adrian Arsht herself lived for many years, a 2020 survey of vulnerable communities had identified their top climate-related concern as heat, ranking it higher than sea level rise and hurricanes. The foundation provided a $50,000 grant the first year to help fund the chief heat officer. Miami-Dade covered the balance and has supported the position since then. Gilbert has brought together a broad coalition of partners, from government to private sector, healthcare professionals to labor organizers. She has been joined by heat officers from Los Angeles and Phoenix, and even as far afield as Greece, Australia, Bangladesh, and Sierra Leone. The officers communicate regularly to share information and innovations. In her first year on the job, Gilbert sought extensive input from residents, researchers, and other parties before drafting the Resilient 305 Extreme Heat Action Plan. 305 is a Miami area code. The three-pronged approach includes educating the public, cooling homes and emergency facilities, and cooling neighborhoods. We really see the heat officer as an extension of the advocacy that we've been doing, says Oscar Ledonio, co-executive director of We Count, an immigrant workers organization in South Florida. We offer advice and input on their messaging, their educational materials, their efforts to try to reach out to workers and their employers. One of Gilbert's first measures was to define heat season as May through October. For the kickoff this year, Gilbert raced from an event hosted by the Chamber of Commerce to the Children's Trust, a state-funded council that supports kids' social services, where she addressed 500 educators. Gilbert's office provides training for camp counselors in English and Spanish, with educational materials also available in Haitian Creole. The sessions cover preventative measures, like limiting exertion and wearing light clothes, as well as the symptoms of heat exhaustion, which include dizziness, heavy sweating, and cool, moist skin with goosebumps. Low-income and unhoused people are more vulnerable to heat illness because they lack access to air conditioning and often shade. Gilbert has asked a volunteer team to steer unhoused people to cooling centers during extreme heat. She was also instrumental in installing 150 bus shelters, providing 1,700 air conditioners to families living in public housing, and planting over 16,000 trees. Increasing the tree canopy is a priority because trees provide shade, lower the ground surface temperature, and offset carbon emissions by capturing carbon dioxide. For nearly two decades, Miami-Dade has struggled to reach its goal of 30% tree cover. Gilbert explains that rampant development and hurricane damage have made meeting this a Sisyphean task. The fact that the country isn't backsliding is an achievement, or that the county isn't backsliding is an achievement, she insists. It's currently hovering around 20%. This year, Miami-Dade will invest a record $7 million in tree planting, with an emphasis on low-income neighborhoods, which tend to have least shade. Gilbert hopes to change county building codes to require more heat-reflective roofs. And she's working with the National Weather Service to lower the threshold for heat advisories in Miami-Dade, during which the county sends warnings and helps get vulnerable people to cooling sites. Extreme heat can cause dehydration, cramps, heat exhaustion, and heat stroke, which can be deadly. Prevention can be as simple as rest, shade, and water. No one understands the hazards of rising temperatures better than outdoor workers. Florida has about 2 million in jobs that include farming, landscaping, roof, and construction. At Miami-Dade's Central District Wastewater Treatment Plant, the structural maintenance team does constant cleaning and repairs. Several years ago, the team switched to four-day weeks with 10-hour days so they can start working earlier in the day when the temperatures are cooler. For the lifeguards at Howlover Beach, long gone are the wooden lifeguard chairs with an umbrella offered a quaint circle of shade. Today, state-of-the-art towers that resemble fancy cabanas on stilts line this stretch of Miami Beach, home to one of the top-rated clothing optional beaches in the country. The flooring is made of aluminum so the lifeguards' feet won't burn, and functioning windows allows for cross-ventilation. Matthew Sparling, a captain in the county's Ocean Rescue Bureau, demonstrates his department's latest purchase, a portable air conditioner that looks like a cooler on wheels and actually uses ice and water to blast cold air. He says his 40 employees are responsible for keeping as many as 4,000 to 6,000 people safe each day during peak season. So if they are listless, the public's safety is in jeopardy. The majority of the lifeguard's job now is medical intervention, often heat-related, and Sparling's crew is trained to identify and treat heat stress, which sometimes presents as a heart attack or stroke. Miami-Dade County employees are protected under an administrative order that Gilbert helped draft. It requires county employers to monitor and mitigate heat risk, offering special training if needed. But the safety of employees at private companies is up to their bosses. Last year, Gilbert and Miami-Dade Mayor Daniela Levine Cava joined a coalition of labor groups and healthcare advocates to draft a measure that would have required the county's private employers to allow 10-minute breaks in the shade every 2 hours when the heat index reached 95 degrees. The Florida legislatures passed a law in April that prohibits local governments from requiring employers to provide rest, water, and shade for workers. The measure went even further, banning local ordinances that require employers to offer appropriate first aid measures or emergency responses related to heat exposure protections for employees who report they have experienced excessive heat exposure. Public records show that the measure passed with lobbying from the Florida Chamber of Commerce and construction businesses. State Representative Tiffany Esposito, who sponsored the bill, insisted that the worker protections would be bad for business. You want to talk about how we can make sure that all Floridians are healthy? You do that by making sure they have a good job, she said. And in order to provide good jobs, we need to not put businesses out of business. The bill's supporters did not address estimates that Miami area businesses lose $10 billion per year in productivity due to heat-related illness. Human beings aren't meant to work 10, 12 hours without breaks in 100-degree heat. Index-like machines, says Ladonio, whose organization helped draft the overruled ordinance. People have to understand that this is not normal, he says. Outdoor workers deserve protections. Earlier this year, the U.S. Department of Labor proposed the first-ever national rule to prevent heat illness in the workplace. No worker should have to get sick or die because their employer refused to provide water or breaks to recover from heat, high heat, or failed to act after a worker showed signs of heat illness, the department declared in a statement. The rule still needs to be finalized, a process that would include review by the public, the president, and Congress. Until then, Florida's law and similar legislation in Texas will remain in place. Floridians are sometimes reluctant to acknowledge the data showing an increasing number of extremely hot days for continuous periods of time. During our research for the story, one tour operator in the Everglades insisted, "It's not getting hotter, people are just getting weaker." Much of Gilbert's challenge is alerting people to the consequences of rising temperatures and convincing them something can and should be done. She says doomsday histrionics in the press aren't always helpful. Instead, she's focusing on measures to mitigate the heat, the tangible actions that will keep Miami-Dade a viable place to live. By addressing this crisis, we have the opportunity to create a better city, says Gilbert with unflappable optimism. Along with the acute measures she's putting in place to provide relief, she envisions a Miami that is more nature-informed, walkable, bikeable, and transit-oriented. As she plants another cypress tree in the mud, she is demonstrating the way forward. Next, we'll move on to an article titled Carving Out the Future by Michael Snyder. Celebrating 50 years of the modernist masterpiece that shocked critics and helped turn D.C. into an arts capital. Immediately after the 1969 groundbreaking for the Hirshhorn Museum and Sculpture Garden in Washington, D.C., Ada Louise Huxtable, then architecture critic for the New York Times, described the planned building as the biggest marble donut in the world. By the time the museum opened to the public, a good 5 years later, a cylinder 231 feet across, clad in concrete panels, hovering like an alien spacecraft along a sunken sculpture garden at the southern edge of the National Mall, critical opinion hadn't softened. Paul Goldberger in The Times called it, quote, a gesture of urbanistic arrogance, end quote, while Harold Rosenberg, writing for The New Yorker, compared it improbably to, quote, unquote, an illuminated babka. Designed by New York-based architect Gordon Bunshaft of Skidmore, Owings, and Merrill, the Hirshhorn could hardly have seemed more out of place, just a block from the respectable neoclassical pastiche of the 1941's National Gallery of Art and less than 4,000 feet west of the Capitol's imperial pomp. With time, though, the building's brashness made it an ideal home for one of mid-century America's most significant private collections of modern art. Until 1962, when the Guggenheim in New York mounted a major exhibition called Modern Sculpture from the Joseph H. Hirshhorn Collection. Virtually no one knew the brilliance, scope, or scale of the mining magnate's collection. Born into poverty in Latvia, Hirshhorn immigrated to the U.S. at age 6, started working as a newsboy at 13, from the 1930s onward, made a fortune speculating in gold, oil, and uranium in Canada. Within a decade, he began to accumulate serious art, eventually building a collection of some 11,500 precious items. At the Guggenheim, 444 sculptures from Hirschhorn's holdings by the likes of Brancusi, Rodin, Picasso, and Arp cascaded down the ramp of Frank Lloyd Wright's iconic Fifth Avenue building. Soon, dignitaries from Beverly Hills to Baltimore, Italy to Israel, began courting Hirschhorn, hoping to secure his collection. But when S. Dillon Ripley, Secretary of the Smithsonian, and President Lyndon B. Johnson offered Hirschhorn a place on the Mall in 1966, the magnate agreed to give 6,000 works to the Smithsonian. With the Hirschhorn donation, Ripley hoped Washington would become an art capital, second only to New York. For decades, neoclassicism had ruled as the capital's official style. And though modernism began creeping into the city's residential, commercial, and diplomatic architecture during the post-World War II boom years, it wasn't until the 1960s that federal tastes formally shifted. In 1963, President John F. Kennedy appointed Bunshaft to the U.S. Commission of the Fine Arts, CFA, which reviewed proposals for new federal buildings. Bunshaft helped usher in such brutalist monuments as Marcel Breuer's Department of Housing and Urban Development and Charles F. Murphy's FBI headquarters. When he presented his plans for the Hirschhorn, Bunshaft described the building as a piece of sculpture, its curving concrete piers growing out like a tree. Despite its reception, the Hirschhorn marked a transformative moment for the Mall. What had been, in Huxtable's unforgettable description, a Brontosaurian marble boneyard, evolved into an eclectic showcase for contemporary design, from Maya Lin's lacerating Vietnam Veterans Memorial to the sobering grandeur of David Adjaye's National Museum of African American History and Culture. Within a decade of the Hirschhorn's completion 50 years ago, in 1974, landscape architect Lester Collins refurbished the original sculpture garden of trees and shrubs to provide shade in the harsh Washington summers, and more recently, a cafe and seating area designed by artist and architect Hiroshi Sugimoto were added to the ground floor. "It's such a serene experience when you're there," says Mary Fitch, executive director of the Washington branch of the American Institute of Architects. Yet the museum's programming has only become bolder. Since the late 1980s, the Hirschhorn's Direction series has showcased artists like Cindy Sherman, Glenn Ligon, Shazia Sikander, offering some their first big break. As the museum's current director, Melissa Chu, puts it, "We're always talking about how to capture the zeitgeist." Since the early 2000s, that has included projecting films onto the museum's curved exterior and, under Chu, commissioning site-specific works from contemporary luminaries like Robert Irwin and Laurie Anderson, who installed their first survey exhibition of her polymathic career there in 2021. But there may be no greater proof of the Hirschhorn's relevance than its ongoing ability to stir controversy. In 2021, plans for Sugimoto to renovate the museum's sculpture garden sparked outrage among architectural conservationists, who saw proposed new elements, including a new reflecting pool and platform performances and a stacked stone partition wall, as anachronistic intrusions on the central work of DC modernism. The new garden, with CFA's stamp of approval, is set to open in 2026. Bunshaft's iconoclastic building has become, perhaps ironically, a monument. For Chu, such changes are essential. "We're fully engaged in revising the 20th century art history that we were all taught," Chu says. From the boneyard that Huxtable described, the Hirschhorn has proved a vital part of the capital's cultural life, a lively, delightful garden, fertile with bold ideas. Next, we'll move on to an article titled "Maestro of Design" by Jeff McGregor. Tyrus Wong spent 106 years making the world more beautiful. A new biography takes us inside his extraordinary life. Tyrus Wong arrived in San Francisco from China in 1920 as a 10-year-old who loved calligraphy. By the end of the next decade, he was working for Disney, on his way to become one of America's greatest immigrant success stories. In his long and varied career, Wong developed a pioneering style, achieving brilliance as a painter, film illustrator, muralist, ceramicist, lithographer, and even a kite maker. Yet the cornerstone of his legendary stature remains his design work for the 1942 film Bambi. Inspired by the simplicities of Song Dynasty landscapes, Wong's influence on Bambi revealed, perhaps for the first time, that an animated feature film could rise to high art. Because of the Chinese Exclusion Act at the time, he couldn't even be a citizen. Marvel's Karen Fang, author of Background Artists, The Life and Work of Tyrus Wong, the definitive new biography, which arrived in October. Fang has been planning this book ever since Wong died in 2016, at the age of 106. I thought there was such an amazing history of this Chinese-American artist who had such a central role in this iconic American film. As Fang recounts vividly in the book, Wong had the prominent fine arts career before he went to commercial art. Wong seems to have drawn little distinction between the two, at least in terms of the artistry he brought to every project. I don't think he ever once saw it as doing lesser, says Fang, a professor of English at the University of Houston. He thought, let me take the opportunity to make something wonderful. Certainly he poured himself into his distinctive Christmas cards, which combine Western traditions with Eastern aesthetic minimalism. These cards, even more than Bambi, brought him true national fame for the first time, selling in the millions. Americans were in droves buying this clearly Chinese-style Christmas card, signed by a Chinese artist, Fang says. They were demanding this expressly bicultural fusion product. Wong had his own signature line within the Hallmark catalog, and by the 1960s, he was being referred to as America's favorite Christmas card designer. Wong's genius reconciled the simplicity of Chinese brushstrokes with the hot rod roar of California modernity. He harnessed his optimism and talent to become, quietly, one of the greatest unsung American artists of the 20th century. Next, we'll move on to an article titled String Theory by David Levine, the plucky design behind the most legendary guitar in all of rock. The man who invented history's most iconic electric guitar couldn't play or even tune it. But when Clarence Leonidas, Leo, Fender's Eponius Company, released the Fender Stratocaster 70 years ago, it forever changed popular music. Fender, born in 1909, began tinkering with radios as a teenager. After college, he built sound systems for a local dance hall in California and started his own company, Fender Radio Service. He also began working with musicians to amplify acoustic guitars, just as electrified sound was becoming the fashion at concerts. Primitive solid body electric guitars had been around since the 1930s, but Fender envisioned a mass-produced, affordable model that would be easier to hold, tune, and play. In 1950, Fender released his first guitar, the Esquire, and the following year rolled out his famous design for the Telecaster. But it was the next design, released in 1954, that would establish Fender as one of the biggest names in guitars. He began designing the Stratocaster, a model that would improve on the Telecaster both electronically and aesthetically, adding a third pickup, a gizmo that turns string vibrations into electrical impulses that can be amplified. The addition allowed players to generate a wider and richer sound palette. Think Jimi Hendrix's incendiary performance of the national anthem at Woodstock. Fender also designed a contoured body that was more balanced and comfortable to play, and looked like something from the future. The Stratocaster was really well designed, in some ways a decade ahead of its time, says Andy Leach, a senior director at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. It had a lot of design features that became industry standard, and it basically has not changed in 70 years, which shows what a genius Leo Fender was. The Stratocaster also had timing on its side. It came out amid two other transformative innovations, television and rock and roll. Sales picked up once Buddy Holly showcased a Strat on the Ed Sullivan Show in 1957. For the American and English kids who came of age in the 60s, Hendrix, Eric Clapton, David Gilmour, the electrified Bob Dylan at the Newport Folk Festival, the guitar's look was as groundbreaking as was its sound. Cool depends more on appearance than on wiring, and Strat's double-cut profile, producing two wings at the top, and the sensuous body lines were mind-blowing. It looked, one early 60s British pop musician recalled, like the equivalent of a bullet-finned 59 Cadillac. Today, the Fender Strat continues to define the look and sound of rock and roll. If you're a guitarist, you either own one or you desperately want one. For everyone else, whenever you're shredding an air guitar solo to Free Bird or Layla, you're shredding a classic Strat. We'll finish up today's program with a quick Ask Smithsonian. Suzanne Epstein of Bethesda, Maryland asks, why do birds and humans have varied songs while most other animals don't sing? Sarah Halliger, curator of birds at the Smithsonian's National Zoo and Conservation Biology Institute, says, like other types of animals, birds have a larynx, a voice box at the top of the throat that vibrates to enable them to vocalize. What's unique to birds is a structure called a syrinx at the lower end of the trachea. The syrinx of birds varies considerably among species. It's most complex in the group of birds known as songbirds. Some birds do not have a syrinx. For instance, New World vultures don't, and they don't sing. For birds that do have them, syrinxes differ greatly among species and even between sexes of the same species, which is why the male often has a more complex song than the female. Birdsong is also influenced by other factors, like the length and diameter of the trachea and the shape and size of the bill. Humans are able to sing for a different reason. We lack a set of vocal membranes that other primates have. Scientists aren't entirely sure why humans evolved without those membranes, but being free of them gives us more vocal stability. We're able to sustain melodious tones and make the range of phonetic sounds we need for complex speech. Although we evolved our musical abilities in a completely different way, the fact that birds can sing no doubt adds to our affinity with them. We've run out of time for today's Smithsonian. This episode, be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Jen Rogers, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's program is underwritten with the generous support of the Kepin family. We wish to thank them for their support. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Smithsonian is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.